Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
Can I have my millennials stand in the right pool of light and my baby boomers on the left pool of light? When it comes to jobs, you should do what you love.
I'm going to say, hell yes, do hell what yes. you love.
Because absolutely.
Because if you don't love it, you won't do a good job, and then you quit and bring the company down, et cetera, et cetera.
I agree. I mean, I've tried to put myself in a position to stay away from things that I don't like. I hated going to school, So I left. And I cannot tell you how powerful that was. I'm the CEO and founder of Tenzo Tea. I went to UCLA, hated going to school, so I dropped out after 3 years and became an entrepreneur.
It just occurred to me, though, I wonder if, maybe we're all fortunate enough that we can, because not everybody gets to just do what they love. Maybe circumstances don't allow that, depending, I'm just fortunate. I was brought up in a family that allowed me to explore options and paid for me to go to college. And even though we all agree that you should do what you love,
yeah, I agree with you completely, and that went through my mind, but I think that it's important, at least for me, to say everyone should be able to do what they love and to have that be an expectation for everyone and not have it be an expectation, okay, well, if you have challenges in your life, then you'll never be able to do what you love.
We had a Japanese restaurant growing up, and I cooked tempura. Did my homework and took naps on the stacks of bags of rice that we had in the back. Did I love it? No. But we did it because it was part of survival. I did computer science and I was a programmer for 10 years before I decided to pursue what I really love, which was music. So, I don't agree with that statement. Do you love all the jobs?
Goal to do what you love, don't you think? Like, to whatever step, you might have to take steps to get to that.
Sure, but that's what I worry about. If we're going to talk about generational differences, I own a couple of businesses in Missouri, and I think sometimes the younger generation doesn't get that part, that to do what you love, sometimes you have to do some things you hate to get there.
Millennials don't work as hard as previous generations.
Shit.
I live in southern Missouri, and I own a couple of businesses there. So I do think when I'm in LA, I notice a big difference. So I think part of it is a geographic thing. I live in a small town in the middle of nowhere where, people don't have role models necessarily that are to look up to that are as motivated. And it's also really easy to get free stuff, low-income housing, food stamps and disability, or they'll come to me and say, well, I can only work 25 hours a week because if I work more than that, I'm going to lose my low-income housing. Like I said, I think that's partly the society where I live makes it too easy not to work.
I think a baby boomer is somebody who is taught to work hard and that if you want something, you have to figure out how to go out and get it and don't wait for somebody to hand it to you. If you try hard enough, you can get about anything you want.
Oh! I wasn't talking about you guys.
So it all depends on who you know and who you run into. Around me, there's sure a lot of millennials that are working hard. And I hear stories about others who are lazy, but isn't that the truth in any generation?
Absolutely.
Facts.
I work with the younger generation all the time. And so I mean, they come in 24/7, you know, they're working very, very hard. And I couldn't work without the younger generation. I wouldn't want to work without the younger generation.
I think millennials work harder than previous generations for less safety nets and less structural stability. And I think you see people who maybe they're not trying to go to work as hard because they know that if they try and they lose whatever assistance they have, or if they try to go to school and they get in debt and they can never pay it out, or know that they can never, you know, live in a place other than that low-income housing unit, then there's like a lack of agency maybe to try, but also so many forces. And then, you know, you have all these companies that are trying to get leaner and deliver on short-term profits, so they hire people as contractors. Like, all my friends are contractors. Like, they don't have health insurance. They don't have any of these other things. And then so, like, they've got to work harder. So I guess when I hear that about millennials, it makes me upset just because sure. I know how hard my friends are working.
I think the word millennial is often used to portray a small slice of millennials. I don't quite fit some of those stereotypes, but I don't think there's a single stereotype either.
Young people today face harder challenges than any previous generation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm actually going to disagree.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, cool. Can't wait to hear that.
I think the biggest challenge facing young people today is the environment, and that we're growing up in a world that is not being taken care of, and what that means for, you know, me and my children, if I have children, what type of world they're going to be living in. And I just think it's not something we're addressing at all.
I think the social media makes it, like I said, it can be a great tool, but I also think it can make life more difficult for people because you can get offended or bullied, or relationships can be totally different now because of, you know, people break up with you over a text or whatever. And I think that adds benefits but challenges too that we didn't have.
As an adult, I find it hard compared to my mother and her generation, when it comes to me trying to buy a house,
sure.
When it comes to me trying to save money, because I'm one of those contractor workers and I do want a family. And so is, do I continue doing what I love, or do I just go back into the rat race and try to get ahead and try to do XYZ? That's the pressure that I face
pressure.
On a day-to-day
and
basis.
There used that's to be like companies that hired you for life, and you had pension, mm-hmm. you had good,
and that's,
you know,
and that's
all gone.
Especially
all
in the startup world.
Cost of living is so high, or if you live in a place where it's not high, then there are no jobs. You know, I think it's harder for you guys.
It's good to hear all your points. I still think that we actually have it a lot easier. And I think the problem is that we expect too much. I don't think that we should deserve to assume that we're going to get to immediately be able to afford a house. And I think that we have a lot of things going for us. And I learned a lot of really valuable skills completely for free. You can join Facebook groups and meet other entrepreneurs. Doesn't cost any money. You can literally take classes at MIT and Harvard for free.
And classes online.
Yeah. And you guys didn't have that. No. The access to information wasn't there. I totally get the financial and environmental challenges, though I think that we have the resources to kind of solve them.
It's important to, you know, want to, you know, have leave each generation better than we found it. Mm-hmm. Because if we lose sight of that, then, you know, what are we working for?
My children will grow up in a better world than I did.
Shit, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because I'll make sure of that.
Yeah, that's, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
For me, I am determined when I do start my family that they will have a better life than what I've had. I'm going to make sure as a father, as a provider, that has to happen, period, point blank.
I don't have children, but I'm speaking for children in general. Even though I first said life is harder for a younger generation, I think you're right. You know, healthcare is getting so much better, so much faster, and the internet has made so many more things possible that I do think that young people will grow up in an easier world overall than we did.
I definitely agree with the personal sentiment that we all share, but I do like think that one of the things we didn't really get to talk about was that, like, we don't necessarily feel that you guys actually set us up for success.
Mm.
Like, Essentially, we built this society where we're told to go to a college, find someone we love, and go buy a house and work a job for 50 years, and we're going to live happily ever after. But it doesn't happen. I just don't get like how you guys assumed that we were going to be able to do that exact same thing.
No. Well, I know I don't assume that, but what I do is that I put the work in. So when you put the work in and
maybe not you per se, but the larger mindset of the boomers is necessarily, you know, you guys work like I did, you guys be okay. Like, nah.
But I think the expectations are changing. Like, everything you said about the house and the marriage, you know, I mean, in my generation, and that was my job as a female, was to catch a husband.
That's right. That's why we went to college. That's why women went to college. That's why my dad
MRS
sent me to college.
And I think your generation has so many more opportunities and a wider vision of what happiness can look like, and that it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to live in a house with a picket fence and you're going to have 2.2 kids and that you're going to stay in the same job forever. I mean, I think you have so many more options available to you. Some of that has shifted for you, so I hope at least it has.
I think that's what I love about the younger generation now, is that they're working on themselves first, as opposed to falling in love and, you know, getting a guy, and that's going to be...
That's all well and good.
So it's
too late.
But I think what we're saying is we've been sold up a creek without a paddle.
Well, I'm a mom, so I'm looking at the future, and I feel for you guys, you know, who you're working hard, which is great, but everything is getting more expensive. The environment, yes, that is a concern. But one of the things that really concerns me is a national debt. And we're borrowing and borrowing from the future. We're kicking the can down the road, letting you guys and your kids and your grandkids take care of it. So I, on behalf of our generation, at least on that aspect of life, we're really sorry. We are. We're leaving a big mess for you guys. And I just pray for you guys, pray for our children. So I am hopeful too. I'm optimistic for our kids, but I'm also well aware of some troubles that we're leaving our next generation. And
I will tell you this, you will survive.
I don't want to survive, I want
you
to thrive.
You will survive.
You are thriven. I want
you
to thrive.
You will survive. You can't be entitled to anything.
We're not entitled. We want what you got. We want the New Deal that Roosevelt set up for Social Security. We want that too. That's all we're saying. We want the basics of the American dream, period.
There you go.
All right, that's all the time.
Mama, give me that. I love it. I love it. Yes, I do.
And welcome to another edition of Salon Talks. I'm Allie Joseph, and today I'm joined by a very interesting author with an equally interesting backstory. Bruce Cannon Gibney, author of A Generation of Sociopaths, How the Baby Boomers Betrayed America. It was named as one of Esquire's 6 books to read after the recent election, and Fortune said it was sure to be controversial. So let's get into it. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm happy you're here. This is a really unique premise, and as Fortune said, a controversial thesis. Tell us a little bit about the book and what the genesis of it was.
Sure. So I really wanted at first to understand why America had been stagnating, because it struck me that every challenge after 1946 seemed fairly trivial to every challenge that had come before, right? There was no continent to settle. There were no world wars to fight. Vietnam was certainly not on the scale of World War I, World War II, and so on down the line. You'd have temporary setbacks like Vietnam or the JFK assassination. But something about American dynamism really seemed to peter out in the 1990s. And I first tried to answer this question in a 2011 essay, What Happened in the Future, which circulated around Silicon Valley, and I thought that Silicon Valley was getting a little too enthused with these sort of Me Too products or the social networks light, so not really your Facebooks, but more sort of your snaps, per se. But obviously the dynamics of national stagnation, you know, transcend like the 25-mile radius around Stanford, and so I decided to push my investigation out further and further, and that eventually led me to the baby boomers, because their policies and their behaviors, both individually and politically, have been radically different than that of any generation we've seen before. And although it's too soon to arrive at a definitive answer, they seem to be quite different from the behaviors and policies of younger generations.
Great. So let's just distill this a little bit. for the people who are watching. A generation of sociopaths makes the, posits that the baby boomer generation is sociopathic in its behavior because it was the first generation to have a completely different approach to life, right? More permissive parenting, more television, TV dinners, perhaps less unity in the family than before. That's a pretty strong premise. You know, nobody likes a sociopath. what do you see the difference is between these folks and how are they responding to this and subsequent generations?
Sure. Well, something like close to 70 million Americans did appear to like a sociopath to one degree or another a few months ago. So, I think the salient difference between the boomers and the generations that came before and the generations that came after are a set of behaviors that I do think correspond to the clinical indicators for sociopathy.
So, which are?
Sure. So, just to summarize, it's basically me first and damn the consequences, but run through the list, it's improvidence, so an inability to plan for the future. You can see this in cohort savings rates, which start falling when the boomers enter the workforce. They really just don't save for their future, and you know, if you're much under 50, you're going to find that out when your parents start coming to you for help. Same thing applies nationally on Social Security, right? So all these personal behaviors translate into international policy. Climate is another sort of indicator of both improvidence and lack of empathy. So they don't really care that much about people other than themselves. Even strange things like an inability to form lasting relationships. You can see this like in the rates of divorce, which are generationally unique at comparable points in marriage. So we only really have data for younger generations through about the 10th year of marriage. So, but if you look at the 10th year of marriage for younger generations versus the prime boomers, you actually see that the rates of divorce have been declining for the younger people. So they can't even, you know, sort of, so not only are they different from prior generations who were sort of famously like, you know, they couldn't get divorced, they were going to stay in it for the children, what have you. They're actually different from their children as well, who were raised in a much more permissive environment and an era of no-fault divorce, no easy divorce. And you can populate the entire clinical checklist this way. And you can see also how it matches to national policy. So, you know, sociopaths tend not to plan for the future. And there's been really a massive subsidence in investments in infrastructure, research and development, all things where the payoffs could be expected to occur after the boomers' lifetimes. And much more towards consumption. So they'd rather allocate those dollars to themselves.
Okay, so you are a smart dude and you use a lot of big words. So let's just distill this for all the people. Boomers, improvident, they don't save, they don't prepare, right? They also lack empathy, a sociopathic trait. They don't really care, you're saying, what happens to the earth. And they aren't good at saving in making decisions, right? So how has that filtered through your book, and how did it prove out? Like, what did you learn after positing that these people are all sociopaths? And what happens to them now?
Right. So I don't posit that all boomers are sociopaths. I just suggest that a very large fraction of them are, and that actually the National Institute of Mental Health conducted a survey in the 1980s. It's one of the few large-scale surveys ever done on American mental health. And they found significantly higher levels of sociopathy in boomer age cohorts then, and speculated that it would get worse over time, and I think it has. And the way that's played out would be irrelevant but for one fact, and that's that the boomers are an enormous generation and have had the opportunity to influence national policy. And within the framework of policy, they're all more or less the same age. And they've cohered rather uniquely, instead of on the traditional lines of sort of race or gender or class, on age-based criteria. So the first and most famous, obviously, was the age-based draft during the Vietnam War. Rather oddly, they all rallied around, as soon as they got the vote, around lowering the drinking age for themselves. That drinking.
So there is a self-interested behavior.
Strongly.
That actually was fun for some people.
It was fun for some people, but frequently fun has consequences for other people.
Doesn't it? It sure does. Yeah.
So when I was born in 1976, the national debt, which is going to be your problem, my problem, children's problem.
Children's problem.
Right, was about 34% of GDP on a gross basis, and today it's 105%. And the CBO projects it's going to be at World War II levels by the end of boomer tenure. Boomers were an absolute majority of the electorate in the early 1980s, and now, so they controlled both the House and the presidency by the early 1990s. And even after 2016, obviously, we have Boomer in the White House again, and they still have a supermajority in the House. And in the book, I do focus mainly on mainstream white Boomers who had a fairly homogenous upbringing, and less so on the minority experience because they had a much more diverse and much different experience. And I think that's what allows one to sort of make certain generalizations about a generation which might otherwise be harder to make, right? So the 1950s that they grew up in were not sort of notorious for their incredible diversity, right? Conformity is the word that leaps to mind. They were all kind of raised in the same way, and they subsequently all sort of behaved in highly similar ways, at least on the policy front.
Mm-hmm. We will talk some more about this, but if you're just joining us, I'm joined today by Bruce Cannon Gibney. I said that right, right? And his new book, A Generation of Sociopaths, How the Baby Boomers Betrayed America, and he has a fairly controversial thesis that many, not all, of the baby boomer generation exhibit sociopathic behavior and that it has thus contributed negatively to the standing of the country, the recent electorate, and that the boomers have squandered the greatest inheritance in history and that they are shamelessly irresponsible about crises from entitlements to the environment, among other things. So how did you decide which population to study within the boomers? Because you just mentioned that it was broken down against, across class lines and perhaps racial, ethnic lines.
Right. So I really approached it sort of like a litigator and engineer. I looked at the numbers and I looked for the flow of money. And I wondered who was benefiting and why, and over what period of time the economy had stagnated. So what you'd expect to see is, as boomers take formal power, it would probably take 2 or 3 years for that power to translate into policy and effect. And so you'd expect to see sort of a rising tide of scandal and corruption and disaster and indifference to the future from, let's say, the mid to late 1990s on, and then the economic consequences of stagnation and rising debt thereafter. And that is, in fact, what happened. And as you look for the people who were in power, they were all boomers, essentially. 79% of the House in 2008, a notable year, were boomers. And their constituents, the political constituents, were boomers. They were the most important electorate. There were more white boomer voters in the 1990s than there were of all minorities combined.
I have a question coming in from our audience here in the interwebs and Facebook, which I think is important because it's a contrast. What are some good things that boomers have created?
So there are large parts of America that are still highly functional, and my premise is not that of the president. Implicit in Make America Great Again is that America is not great now. I actually do. America is better now than it was when I was born.
And we do all also have, I think, generationally, the premise that every generation wants to do better for its children than we were able to do, than the parents were able to do. And so is that happening?
No, it's not. There is a paper from Brookings, and there's plenty of data in the book. So cohorts that were, in their 20s to 30s in the 1980s, that is to say, sort of boomerish cohorts, experienced substantially rising incomes over their working lives. That's much less true today. I think most of your viewers who are much under 30 will have viewed the past decade, the first decade of their working lives, as at best a wash, and certainly substantially below expectations. And the literature suggests that basically you never recover from early life income losses. So there's already sort of a tangible effect, even for people who are just entering the workforce. And that's disappointing. And I think the greater challenge over the long term is the boomers inherited a country that, you know, whatever its difficulties in the 1970s, the 1970s, by the way, were not the total disaster show that they've been made out to be. They were bad, but they weren't as bad as the most recent Great Recession. So average wages experienced growth, even though there was a huge population of boomers looking for work, even though we were just recovering from a war, even though there were crises, that exogenous crises like the oil crisis that caused any number of problems. But all the freeways were great, the dams weren't bursting, you know.
and now 40 years later,
right,
it's like a scene from a CGI movie with like just stuff falling down and things leaking and overflowing, and we really do have a lot of infrastructure problems.
We do. I mean, there are actually states where there are no inspectors of dams, right?
So, can you imagine, like, look at California, look at what's happening.
And California's a good state.
Yes. It's amazing, although we'll see if the current administration actually does one of the things that they said, Mr. Trump said, and bringing more jobs and infrastructure.
I'm sure he will to certain areas. So if he wants infrastructure, there were projects that were ready to go, like high-speed rail and electrification of trains in California. Obviously, California is the home of godless Clintonistas, so that funding was pulled earlier this week.
And Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Who he loves. Who's great, who's not a boomer, he's an immigrant. I exclude from my calculations immigrants because they don't have the same sort of relatively homogenous upbringing. But I think the blue states, which is where the people live and where the money are going to be screwed, if I can say that on...
Go ahead.
All right, I think blue states...
We're screwed here in New York.
And we're going to be held hostage by the red states. So the blue states are actually net exporters of, let's just be honest, it's welfare to the central states, and the degree of subsidy is going to deepen under this administration because that's where the present administration's base lies. So even though the obvious place to spend on infrastructure is where there are a lot of people crammed into one place producing real economic output, we're going to build more bridges to nowhere or, you know, highways in the middle of Iowa, and that's how things are going to go. Meanwhile, New York is going to experience funding losses. California is going to experience funding losses. Even the proposals about reforming taxes are in some ways an attack on the younger, more liberal coasts. So that once you eliminate the deductibility of state income taxes, for example, you're punishing working people, that is to say younger people, the boomers who are approaching retirement or are already retired, and you're punishing liberal values.
We could really get deep into some of the ironies in the statistics that you just cited, but then we would be here all day. Much as I would like to, that'd be really interesting. I mean, you know, sort of like, we're going to create these jobs in this outdated industry, and so nobody will be on welfare, but the wealthy states will export more people. So there's all kinds of contradictions. I think I wanted to go back to what you said about the millennials and the generation and the descendants of the boomers. How did the boomer behavior as parents perhaps negatively affect their children and how they have perceived this world of entitlement and the behaviors that are often mocked, you know, in comedy and so forth at the moment? Because, you know, this is like the millennials, you know, people who have no consciousness. All the studies show that that I've seen anyway, that they only want to do jobs that have a social relevance or, you know, some sort of social benefit, and yet they don't want to get out of bed and go to work. So,
yeah, I don't know how many of those studies I believe. I think the millennial, and to the extent that people want to do jobs that have social meaning, I think that's a good thing. This may be one way in which the boomers have actually done pretty well, is I think they raised their children as best they could on an individual level. Unfortunately, they pursued policies that are going to make it very difficult for their children to, sort of as they used to say, be all they can be. Because in 2030, when we inherit this mess, we'll have World War II levels of debt, we'll have unaddressed climate change, Social Security will be about to run partially insolvent, that happens in 2034, coincidentally, right around the actuarially forecasted demise of the median boomer, and so on down the line. And for however much young people want to do a good job, when you arrive at a very stressful period in history where all the problems were, in fact, actually avoidable, and that's the true tragedy, asking people to behave incredibly selflessly gets harder and harder. And at a certain point, it's not a probable outcome. And so no matter how good the millennials are, and they're a very diverse generation, much harder to characterize than the boomers, who are sort of 78% white and all raised in roughly the same way, and the millennials are much more pluralistic and diverse and of different backgrounds. The boomers have bequeathed a situation which may make it extremely difficult for the millennials to live up to their own aspirations.
Okay, so I'm now thoroughly depressed. It's only 12:30 on a 11:30 on a Tuesday. But to borrow from host Ryan Seacrest, tell me something good. Is there something that we can do now and in future policy to correct some of the mistakes of the boomer generation?
Yeah, absolutely. The window of time is short. But fortunately, we have elections every 2 years and every 4 years. So in 2018, I think people, younger people especially, 2018, by the way, is the first time the millennials will outnumber the boomers, as I define them. We can start voting against these policies. I didn't think there was a realistic chance of that happening in 2016, and in fact, it did not happen. But in 2018, there will be a chance in the midterms. In 2020, there will definitely be a chance to have a referendum about what is happening now. And we can pursue much more pro-social policies. We can try and fix Social Security. It's much cheaper to do now than it is to do later. We can try and address the climate in a truly serious way. So this month's decision to undo the Obama administration's entire environmental legacy is unhelpful, and yes, that cost will come back compounded in 4 years. But it will still be bearable. But the time to do something is in the next four years.
Well, which would imply that people young and old have to mobilize now, and there is so much action, you know, that we see every day to the point where it's difficult to even keep up with all the rallies and the activism and stuff like that. So what do you think the most concerted way and the most efficient way to affect the midterm elections is?
Vote. Millennial voter participation rates are lower. That's normal. Younger people tend to vote less frequently than older people. And the choices in 2016 were less than ideal. The only real champion of youth was Bernie Sanders. He was not an option by the end. So go
very
there
diplomatic
and vote.
Of you, by the way. I am going to put my hands in the frame here.
Yes. Hands. Very good.
Yes. Yeah. That's the Democratic Party would not put him up, and so yes, he was not an option. And some people are still disappointed about that. And but voting, of course, and there was a groundswell of people who came out after the recent elections and were protesting, to which people said, well, but did you vote? And then we saw that shocking statistic of how few people actually came out because they thought it wouldn't make a difference, which is a terrible premise and will never affect change.
Right. But, for now, we have a relatively free franchise. The boomers haven't been particularly keen on that, as they're voting, they're gerrymandering, their gutting of the VRA, and so on down the line, have shown. That's the sort of, we can debate about abortion, we can debate about gay rights all day long, but the one core value in the United States is one person, one vote. Now, it took a long time to get there, but by 1965, that had become something of a reality. And for as long as we have the franchise, which they're working on right now, so enjoy it while you've got it, use it.
Okay.
Use it. It's really that simple. And then in personal behaviors, don't expect too much from the boomer government. So save, conserve to the extent that you can, plan for a long working life, and every 2 years when you have the chance to go into the voting booth, ask yourself if your representative, your senator, your president, has really done a good job for you. And if the answer is no, then vote them out. You know, most people vote for incumbents. Most of the incumbents are boomers. And if you believe sort of my thesis, then most of the boomers should be viewed with at least some degree of suspicion. These people just keep coming back and back and back. And, you know, if you want to look for causality, just look at the people who've been in charge and the people who've benefited from these policies. And they're overwhelmingly boomer politicians. So let's get rid of them. I mean, certainly, you know, 25, 30 years is more than enough.
It is more than enough. So you heard it here. If you want to affect change, you have to vote. And you also have to follow the policies and the suggestions of an actuary and squirrel stuff away and save, which ironically was sort of the province of older generations. We've been here with Bruce Cannon Gibney, author of a controversial book, and if you've been watching, a controversial thesis, but a very interesting and proven out thesis, that the boomer generation is a generation of sociopaths. And the book explores how the baby boomers betrayed America. Where and when can we buy this book?
It is on sale today, available at your online or local retailer. Thank you.
And you too.
A McKinsey study showing that buyers over the 60-year mark are becoming the world's biggest spenders. So could it mean the slowdown of the lucrative marketing to the millennials, the prized generation? Jan Rogers Niffen is a consultant and former retail executive, and Jason Dorsey is Generational Kinetics co-founder. That's an interesting title, Jason. You come to us from Austin, South by Southwest, which I just characterized as the millennials' Woodstock. Why, Jason, do you think? why, Jason, do you think that advertisers are so focused on the 25-year-old cohort or so?
Mm-hmm. Well, for a few reasons. Most of all, we're up for grabs. We have the least established loyalty. We're trendsetters. People look to us as the future. And that's also, of course, a challenge because we don't necessarily have the money. We still live with our mom. But we're increasingly earning money and spending more money. And we're the hot group. It's always been the 18 to 34.
But I thought you weren't spending more money, and because you're spending more money on your student debt.
We are drowning in student debt. It is an emotional and an economic anchor for us. However, us spending more money doesn't mean we're outspending other generations. And I think that's the key. We're sexy, we're hot, we're young, we're the ones driving it like South By. But ultimately, we're seeing older generations are still leading the spending power. In fact, a new study we just did with Global Cash Card found 5 million working millennials who are working right now do not even have a checking account.
He's sexy, he's hot, he's young. Now meet Jan Rogers Niffen. We're going to bring it home here for the old guys, pal.
And they only had me on today because I'm old,
you're,
right?
You're sexy, you're hot, you're smart, and you got the money, man.
And I'm the leading edge of the boomer generation.
Yeah, me too.
And we were the biggest spenders, and now worldwide in the U.S.
But now we are, right?
Be
because
the biggest spenders.
The numbers on automobile sales, it's like 2/3 of new cars bought in the U.S. were bought by people my age.
Well, it's because millennials don't buy. Millennials lease. Millennials are the leasingest generation ever.
Right.
Are they Uber? They use twice as often as we do. They use public transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And they also buy things that we don't buy.
So
they
why don't more market? Marketers target the baby boomers, the people that gots the money and spends the money.
It's just starting again. They always did. They fell off a little bit thinking that the millennials were going to take that over. The millennials are saving too much to be the next generation. The millennials are spending more on experiences. They're not spending it on stuff.
Yeah.
And when they start spending it on stuff, we'll go back to marketing to them.
They sell us Viagra and prostate drugs. That's pretty much all I see. So, Jason?
We're going back. They're going to sell us stuff again.
Do you see a turn here where marketers will start spending more to reach people like me who do things other than take Viagra and prostate drugs, by the way?
I didn't know that. That's shocking. Yeah.
I'm oversharing, Jason.
Yeah, that was a little too much. Thanks, Dad. But what I do want to point out is that, yes, we're not buying things right now. You're absolutely right that we are renting and leasing. However, and you mark my words on this, and our data is proving this out, once we start getting married and having kids, both of which we're doing much later than ever before, we will start spending. But right now, we've had a really tough entry into the workforce. We haven't been able to really build any nest egg. No, look, our nest egg is our parents. But it is finally starting to turn. And I do want to point out that in the U.S., millennials, more than any other generation, support their parents financially. One of the studies we just did showed that. So you're right. Overall, boomers are spending the money. But millennials, we're going to get there.
And we know they're going to win, right? Because we already know the date where there's going to be more more millennials than there are boomers, and it's not because there's more of them being born.
We're going to have you guys back. That was too much fun. Jason Dorsey, thank you very much.
My name is Lincoln Anthony Blades. I write about politics and culture, and I'm also a millennial. I want to talk to you about millennial entitlement. Millennials, in case you were wondering, are those of us born between the early 80s and 90s. We're frequently the subjects of studies and think pieces trying to figure out what we want and why we're struggling in today's economy. The usual conclusions are we're lazy, coddled, unfocused, and fragile. Terms which fall under one singular label, millennial entitlement. It's a term used to degrade our competency and work ethic, but that term is nonsense. Allow me to explain. Growing up, we were taught that if we went to school, worked hard, and got good grades, we'd get good, well-paying jobs. So we took that advice, and we went on to become the most educated generation this nation has ever seen. A recent survey revealed that 36% of employers had begun hiring university graduates for jobs that once only required a high school degree. And we're not talking about high-level jobs, we're talking about mailroom attendants and telemarketers. The choice faced by many of my peers is this: hunt for a dead-end, low-paying job you're overqualified for, or accept an unpaid internship along with thousands of other young Canadians and pray you get a job in your chosen field. Despite having the world's third highest level of educational achievement amongst OECD countries, we lead those countries in having the largest share of graduates earning less than the national median income. But these facts don't paint the full picture. We're regularly labeled as entitled narcissists who demand work-life balance because we're too soft to deal with hard work. But maybe those who have this view don't realize that a decade ago, my generation was forever changed by the global economic crisis. Older millennials, like me, found ourselves facing our first mass layoffs at jobs we'd only been at for a few years. People 28 and younger accounted for almost 70% of the job losses during the 2008 recession. Millennials graduating from university at the time faced a job market so grim, they just went back to school. And if you were in high school or college back then, you saw your parents unceremoniously lose the jobs they devoted so much of their entire lives to. We saw and experienced what blind corporate devotion gets you, and we want no part of it. And now, here we stand, 10 years later, thrust into a new economy and facing a new reality we were never prepared for, and we're making the best of it. Many of us have side hustles that we use to supplement our income in order to survive and get ahead. That isn't the mark of a lazy and entitled generation. That's the work of a group determined to create their own chances and their own luck. For The National, I'm Lincoln Anthony Blades.
This next story is about the generational divide, how different people of different ages view different topics, things like climate change, but also things like sexism or racism, or even just the accusations of those kind of things. There's a term swirling nowadays, okay boomer. It's going viral, being used by those who are in their teens or even younger, maybe young adults, to try and say to an older person, for example, that their views are out of touch or old-fashioned. Some are calling it a rallying cry for Generation Z. To discuss things a little further, we've got Dewan Nanda and Shannon Burns joining us from downtown Toronto for more on OK Boomer. All right, so Shannon, your read on what this actually means here. When somebody says to you, or when you say to somebody, OK Boomer, what are you trying to say?
I feel like for a very long time now, a lot of baby boomers have taken the term millennial and they've turned it into something that's a little derogatory or a little bit negative towards us. And I feel like this is our chance to kind of take that power back and kind of turn it on them instead and kind of use the term baby boomer in a little bit of a derogative way. Obviously, we're doing it in a very joking way, but to me, it means any chance to let an older person know that when they're poking fun at us, we can turn that right around and then poke fun at them.
Is this kind of thing due in ageist, though? In other words, are you targeting baby boomers and saying, yeah, okay, boomer, you're totally out of touch. You got no idea what you're talking about. You know, go sit in a corner. Thank you very much.
Well, somebody this morning told me that baby boomer is called so because the moment they hear something they don't agree with, boom, they become babies. But, you know, I'm just kidding. I actually am not so much of a boomer hater, to be honest, because I've been lucky to have good boomers in my life. But you're right. There's a lot of them out there who are calling this a slur. Some even comparing it and calling it the N-word of ageism, which is totally out of line. In fact, to the point that even the dictionary had to step in and clarify that a boomer is a term literally meant for somebody born between 1946 and 1965, and it is in no way a slur. So people need to just calm down a little bit.
Why is it, Shannon, though, just to push back a little bit, why is it that the folks who are in sort of the millennial Gen Z category, why are they right?
Why are they right? Ooh, that's a very good question. It's not that we're necessarily in like a right or wrong. I don't know if I'd necessarily see it that way, but there are certain issues that I feel like are getting blamed on us, or there's certain stereotypes that are being given to us. So like I said, it's just our way of retaliating back to these baby boomers and letting them know that, no, certain topics aren't necessarily our fault. They could maybe more align with your fault, but it's not like we're poking either way, so.
I think climate change doing is kind of an interesting one as well, because, you know, this is something that is very important to a lot of people from a certain generation, to a lot of people from a lot of different generations. But there may be a difference in how important it actually is. Or, you know, I'm thinking about Greta Thunberg, of course, and you know, the different roles that she has played. And there have been some who say, OK, enough is enough. And then others who say, OK, hold on a second. You know, this woman really has something to say. She's a teenager, of course, but she's got a lot of important things on a very important issue here. And you can kind of see how people might have different opinions just of her.
Absolutely, because when a lot of these baby boomers were young, when they were 15, 16 years old, they were able to blissfully ignore these problems because they weren't facing them in such a serious and real way as it is to us. You know, everything from the huge disparity between income and housing prices to living in a digital age with an overwhelming amount of information and how we're navigating through that. You know, being in a job market with absolutely no job security, but with an abundance of overqualified and overeducated people who are buried in student debt. I mean, these are things that you can't really argue with because it's just what's happened as a result of the situation out there right now. And so it's not so much that we're complaining and that we're, you know, trying to say that we're right. It's just a plea for some understanding. I mean, I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day who's 22 years old, and we're talking about this documentary that we watched on Netflix called Game Changers and the benefits of adapting a plant-based lifestyle and not only how much it can affect our health, but the environment. And in walked somebody who was, you know, in their 50s, and they kind of were making fun of us saying, you know, you kids, like, you need to stop worrying about this stuff. When we were that age, we just worried about where we're going to go get some chicken wings. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's why we're sitting here talking about environmental problems, because you didn't care about it back in the day. And so there's that discrepancy that's definitely causing some problems.
Yeah, and whether it's about the environment or about race issues or about gender issues, terminology that we use, how we refer to people if they want to self-identify and all of this kind of stuff. I mean, to a certain extent as well, Shannon, it can sometimes break down along perhaps politically ideological division, where some on the left versus some on the right. It's gotten to the point where there's even, you know, now apparel being sold, and we're going to show this sweatshirt, which is an OK Boomer sweatshirt, and it says at the bottom, have a terrible day. OK, Boomer, have a terrible day. I mean, how much of this as well is just that, you know, with social media, people like this kind of stuff, the trends, they say it, they put it on a video, and it becomes kind of like a, you know, a meme of sorts.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like this has always been an issue generation after generation. Of course, when the baby boomers were younger, I'm sure that they had issues with the generations that were older than them. And it's going to happen again with us when we look down on younger generations as we get older. So I feel like, but since we're in the age of social media and we're in the age of memes, this has become so huge and we can communicate it so much better because we have things like Twitter and all of these memes and things. So it definitely has expanded the whole issue, and it's given people a platform in order to complain about baby boomers, and baby boomers then complain about millennials, and it just goes on from there.
You know, and so you see this stuff coming up on TikTok as well, as people post on social media different things about boomers. The other interesting thing doing as well is, you know, I'm doing a little bit of research before I came on the air, and there are those who say, you know, the term boomer is actually not necessarily only about baby boomers. It can be anybody who doesn't get it. So you can sort of say to someone, for example, someone who's a Gen Z could say to you, doing as a millennial, they could say, okay, boomer, to you. It doesn't mean you're a baby boomer, because obviously you're not, but it's still kind of sending that message.
No, you're absolutely right. Like, I would say the translation of that is pretty much, ugh, old people just don't get it. And how old that is that doesn't necessarily matter. I mean, I've caught myself being like, and in talking about Generation Z, being like, oh my God, those kids on their TikTok and obsessed with Snapchat and, you know, and it's just, I find myself and I'm like, okay, maybe I need to stop talking down to them a little bit. But it's just like Shannon said, it's generational. It's always going to be there. And no matter how much we try, there's going to be that divide. And it's a result of the environment that you grow up in and the situations that you're faced with. So there's always going to be a difference. But I think what makes it better for everybody is to not be as judgmental, not be condescending, and try to understand and look at things from their perspective. So kids these days who I find are struggling a lot more with anxiety and depression as a result of constant social media exposure. I can't just tell them, hey, get off social media, go outside and play, because it's not that easy. And so you have to understand what they're faced with and how they've grown up and what best way you can do to actually make them feel more supported.
Okay, boomers, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Ted.
We're not the boomers, actually.
To Ananda and Shannon Burns, great to have the two of you with us.
Thanks, Todd.
I keep talking about how millennials get a bad rap. I mean, look, there isn't an article that comes out, or I should say there isn't a day where an article doesn't come out about how millennials are lazy or entitled or spend too much money on iPhones and avocado toast. Okay. However, when it comes to being entitled, for example, and there are lots of different things that we've had to go out and debunk, talking points from people who don't understand what's going on with millennials, with this generation, and the problems this generation faces. Well, this one involves debunking the entitlement mentality. Again, they always like to say, millennials are entitled, they're entitled, right? They want everything handed to them. That's actually not true. It turns out that according to a study, millennials actually have very high expectations of themselves and try very hard to fit those expectations. Now, what do I mean by that? What kind of expectations? According to this study from Bankrate.com, millennials think that people should be on their own far earlier than previous generations. Let me give you an example. According to this study, millennials say that people should be able to pay for their own housing at the age of 22, pay for their own car at 20 and a half years of age, and be responsible for their own cell phone bill at 18 and a half years of age. Now, in my personal experience, I hit those all around 20. Car at 18, phone a lot later on, because again, we didn't have smartphones. Back in my day, I didn't have no smartphone. I had a brick, so with a screen with green letters. So I had one of those. Now, as far as housing, that was about the same time, 21. So I'm actually doing pretty good. Now, how does this stack up against baby boomers? Well, in all three cases, the younger cohort's average response is about a year and a half earlier than when baby boomers feel these three landmarks of financial independence should happen. So millennials are like, yeah, I've got higher expectations of myself. I want to pay my own phone. I want to pay for my own car. I want to have my own apartment or my own house way earlier than what boomers say that people should have it. So by their own admission, yes, we want to get out of the nest sooner, take care of ourselves faster than other previous generations. Now, that doesn't mean millennials are able to do so. Expectation and reality happen to be different. Now, according to the U.S. Census data, analyzed by real estate listing Trulia, around 40% of millennials still live at home. That is the largest percentage since 1940. More data from the Pew Research Center says that for the first time in more than 130 years, American adults aged 18 to 34 were more likely to live with their parents than with a spouse or partner in their own household. So let me give you a little context on those numbers. Now, I think part of that is where is related to the fact that younger people aren't getting married. Okay, you're not getting married. You're not moving in with people. You're not on your own. Two incomes. Unfortunately, you need two incomes to be able to afford a place in the current housing situation. Even rent-controlled apartments are very, very difficult to get into because there's not a lot of those available. So housing is more expensive. You normally need two incomes. There's not a lot of jobs, and there's a lot of student loan debt. So there's this perception of millennials, and unfortunately, the stay-at-home stat feeds into these as people who aren't interested in settling down. Oh, you got the hookup culture. They're immoral. They're just having sex. They're having fun. And they're lazy, right? They don't want to leave home because they get all their stuff taken care of and they live for free. Okay, well, some of that is based on economic issues. I'll point that out. As well as millennials, I think, thanks to our unique upbringing, have different changing, evolving opinions on marriage. In fact, psychologist, relationship expert, and author of The Ultimate Guide to a Multi-Orgasmic Life, oh, that sounds great, Antonio Hall tells Bustle, many millennials were raised with rising divorce rates and broken homes, so they're far less likely to buy into marriage as the only best form of relationship for themselves. Add to that the increase in educational costs and debt, and millennials feel financially less secure, which makes entering into what's considering a binding contract with their significant other far less appealing. Now, so look, you take in that, those changing attitudes, and less millennials leave the home, or they do so later on, get married and start families because, again, some of these different issues. And now we'll talk about the economic part. Now, they don't have a lot of money because you have stagnant wages and giant amounts of student loan debt. In fact, millennials shoulder more student loan debt than any other generation and face housing prices that are far higher than their parents did at their age. As of right now, student loan debt has reached $1.3 trillion and the cost of college has soared. So that's, I mean, that's what's facing millennials right now. Now, it used to be a rule, right, where, hey, man, don't try not to spend more than 30% of your income on rent or a mortgage. You want to make sure that, you know, you don't spend that much so you can save money for retirement, buy things, and just be prepared financially to handle this. Well, unfortunately, most people aren't able to do that, especially millennials. In fact, in 2017, the median amount most renters pay is 40% of their income on rent. That is nearly half, sometimes more. And in no state in America right now can the minimum wage actually get you a two-bedroom apartment. So you're not able to afford that. Now, there's a lot of different reasons of this housing disparity. Again, the lack of affordable housing in a lot of cities. You also have gentrification, and you also have foreign buyers that come in and snatch up houses with cash. Cash always wins, unfortunately. And so, you know, that inflates home prices. And again, with that student loan debt, a lot of people don't have that disposable income. Stagnant wages, you know, that make it very, very difficult for millennials to be able to afford to get into housing. So a lot of people don't really have much of a choice. If you work a minimum wage job, even if you have a degree, you've got that student loan debt to take care of. You can't find affordable housing if you're in a big city, San Francisco, LA, New York, for example, where homes can cost upwards of over $1 million for like a condo or a decent sized home. Well, what options do you have other than staying at home? So, but regardless of all this, millennials still have higher expectations for themselves. And when they do so, they still can't compete. Now that's sad, because look, some of the hardest working, most innovative people are millennials. And all they're trying to do is they're trying to make the best out of a bad situation. Now, speaking as a millennial, we didn't have the ability to put ourselves through college, only working part-time like a lot of boomers did. I don't begrudge them that. In fact, I'd love to go back to that. That'd be great. I'd love to work myself, or I'd love to have had the ability to work myself through college, working part-time at a fast food restaurant, bussing tables. Oh, that'd be great. Instead, people taking out, even for community college, which is a lot cheaper, still up to $20,000-$30,000 in student loan debt. Now, a lot of us also didn't have the ability to buy a home straight out of high school, being able to get some of those manufacturing jobs that paid well above minimum wage. Those don't really exist anymore. Now, to be fair, I knew a couple of people. I graduated with a couple of people who did that, who did get those jobs and were able to buy a home, and then lost it during the financial crisis of 2008, a crisis that millennials didn't cause. So there's that as well. And again, that's my personal anecdote. Take that as you will. Look, millennials didn't cause outsourcing. Millennials didn't cause stagnant wages. They didn't cause increasing healthcare costs. We didn't cause bad trade deals. All we're doing is simply living in the world and making the best of the world that was left to us by some of the mistakes of the previous generations. So I guess my whole point is, maybe instead of calling us entitled, why not help us? Help us to fix those mistakes and to help us fix this situation so that millennials can go out and succeed and not have to stay at home and not have to forego marriage and not have to forego buying homes and cars. Fixing the problem is much more effective than blaming the people who are being the most affected by it.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Ramir Diesel Guy, and welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode addendum. I'm actually recording this for the second time. I can't remember the first time I actually heard the phrase, okay, boomer. But I knew, upon hearing it, that it was meant to be a derogatory term. That it was meant to slap disrespectfully boomers. I went to my niece, who I often go to for cross-generational information that I'm not privy to, and she was quick to explain to me that boomers think they get her generation. They think they get her generation, and many of them don't. Many of them aren't in the realm of getting their generation. Moreover, when her generation, technically she is a millennial, by the way, the old years for millennials went from the very early 80s to at least the year 2000, hence them being called millennials. Some of the newer date ranges I see literally stop at like 96 or 97. And I'm like, yeah, but then you're not a millennial. I mean, the whole idea was it went up to the millennium. The other range went to 205, which is the one that I often cite and the one I often use. Because, you know, I believe in making sense, news media. That stated. She said, look, when we try to explain ourselves and our generation to the boomers, they don't want to listen. They believe they know better than us, a about who we are and what we need to believe and why we need to believe it. And it's very frustrating because if they would listen, they might learn a thing or two about who we are and what we need and why we need it. But they don't want to listen. I took everything she said to heart. Obviously, I'm recounting it back to you. But I thought about it. I thought about it. And I thought that it was very interesting in a very odd way. The baby boomers were the generation that sparked the 60s and the 70s. Baby boomers began to be literally born right after GIs returned home from World War II. Hence, 1946 is typically the starting point of the baby boomer generation. Some people, for some stupid reason, have tried to move the baby boomer generation up a little bit to the early 40s, thus marking or creating a parallel between the United States entering World War II and the increase in the population via these new births, even though the measurable spike that is often called the boom wasn't really until 46, 47, 48. After the war. Anyway, the people who were born in 1946, 1947, 1948, these are the individuals who were 20 years old. 20 years old and in their early 20s in 65, 66, 67, 68, 69, 70, 71, 72, 73, 74, 75. The further away from World War II the generation went, the less radical it seemed to get. But the Silent Generation, which I had a clip about the Silent Generation in the last episode of this, which is one of the reasons why I am re-recording this, because I didn't have that information prior to, so I can incorporate it now. They played a huge role in the 60s. They did play a much larger role in the 60s than the baby boomers. This is actually quite important because oftentimes the baby boomers are kind of aligned with what happened in the 60s and the 70s, when the reality is, it seems the more baby boomers matured into adulthood, the more their influence was flexed towards ending the productivity of the previous generation in spreading social welfare throughout this country. In other words, the baby boomer generation was a selfish generation. The baby boomer generation was a selfish generation. And their inability, their unwillingness to listen to previous generations or future generations started nearly immediately. A lot of the movements that were begun by the wayward 20-somethings, and particularly the people in the early 20s and late teens in the 60s, a lot of those movements fizzled out rather quickly. Now, some of that was due to the state. Some of that was due to law enforcement. Some of that was due to people maturing out of those movements. But a lot of those desires, which were not rooted necessarily in the, and this is something Dr. King talked about in his Massey lectures, particularly, I think it was Massey lecture number three, they were not rooted in the philosophies of their parents, of their grandparents. These were radical philosophies. Dr. King mentioned in that Massey lecture, number three, that many of the new generation, you're talking young people, you know, in their very early 20s, in their late teens, who were spouting a lot of radical rhetoric, a lot of those people did not have the radical education of their parents and of their grandparents. And whereas I have been very harsh on the grandparents and on the parents, I think that's a little unfair. Because from what I'm starting to understand, there were enough people around who could have taught the baby boomer generation about the radical, the philosophical foundation for their radical thinking. But a lot of the young people, I think, weren't willing to listen. And for various reasons. I mean, this country had begun to overflow with jobs, and the drive was more towards getting in where you fit in, and a lot of those jobs were paying at least mostly white people very, very well, and the market had opened up drastically when it came to opportunities to start businesses and to do other things within entrepreneurial lanes because of the work of the previous generation. So a lot of people were focused on getting their success in order, not understanding as they went into business, as they took advantage of the opening markets that the previous generation had pried open, as they took advantage of the regulatory juggernaut that had made it possible for smaller companies to enter markets and to do well, because regional competition and local competition was a focus of a lot of that regulation. As these people moved into getting their success in order, they did not understand, nor did they want to understand, what type of economy had preceded this bountiful landscape of business opportunities. They didn't want to know the radicalism and the radical philosophies that had gone into creating the foundation for all of this. What they wanted to know was how best they could utilize what was bequeathed them. And as they began to get around business-oriented people who cared nothing about the social welfare systems, who cared nothing about the gains for society that had been made throughout the New Deal years and the post-New Deal years, who cared nothing about true competition. These individuals were often molded, usually through alliances like the Chamber of Commerce, into individuals who promoted and advocated and fell head over heels over the concept of a free marketplace without the pesky regulation that made it possible for them themselves to be prosperous. this was the beginning for the baby boomers entering maturity. Since so many of them entered maturity in the new middle class, which was a new thing, y'all, it's really hard to get y'all to understand that what is happening presently, where the middle class is shriveling up and dying, that is actually the way the middle class was designed to be in the United States. The oligarchy that ran the United States in the 1800s wanted a middle class that was literally noble-like. There was not a huge middle managerial class. There was a middle class that, yes, was managerial, but had so much more money than the average peasant American that they were themselves considered quite rich. We are now moving to a position where that is becoming the norm again. But I digress. Because so many of these baby boomers entered life in the new middle class, seeing the need and the wisdom behind a social safety net and behind social welfare was nearly impossible if they weren't raised in an area where they were not only taught to be compassionate, but it was a mandate by their parents to be considered well-adjusted. Most people didn't have that and would never have that. So, when their parents voted for politicians based on depriving basically non-white people of the same privileges and opportunities that they had taken advantage of, many of them listened eagerly to the explanations of their parents as to why they did this, and many of them repeated the horrible actions when it was their turn to vote. The first real assertion of political power by the baby boomer generation is often considered the mid-1970s congressional delegations. I read an article some time ago, and this was, I think, mentioned in Rick Perlstein's book about Watergate, that a lot of historians place the baby boomer shift in Washington to the Watergate babies, but that may just be opinion rather than fact. But definitely by the late 70s, the baby boomer generation was the generation to consider for everything marketing, promotion, and advertisement related, and they were the driving force in political thought and thinking. Now, obviously, there was a lot of older people from other generations that were still writing, that were still publishing, that was still engaged in politics. I mean, don't forget George Herbert Walker Bush and Ronald Reagan were still yet to become national figures, and both of them were born, I believe during, I don't remember when Reagan was born. I remember Bush was born, if I remember correctly, during World War I. But that being said, the baby boomers were making a lot of political decisions by the late 70s. And they seemed more than willing to tear up all of the hard work of the previous generation, and they didn't seem willing to listen to the previous generation and what they had learned. Now, I somewhat understand that, You know, you were dealing with a very sensitive generation in comparison to their parents who were not that sensitive. So I understand that. But at the same time, the people who they should have been listening to, they weren't. There was a story that was recounted by, actually, I can't remember which book it was in. It was either in Rick Perlstein's book, Nixonland, or in the book Rule and Ruin. Well, there was another book that it might have been from. I really can't remember which book this came from, but I really think it was in Nixonland. When the Watergate babies came into Congress, particularly into the House of Representatives, they deposed or they kicked off of a committee a Democrat from the South because he had been a supporter of Jim Crow laws. He had also been a New Dealer, and he has supported a ton of legislation that was beneficial to the people of his district, including some for blacks too, but he often had to exclude blacks because of Jim Crow. So they kicked him off because, look, you're a racist and that's it. What they didn't realize was his seniority and his knowledge of politics in the region gave him the ability to navigate dangerous political waters and to get things done for the black communities down there and for the white communities down there that other politicians found difficult to do in neighboring districts. He ended up, I think he ended up getting beat by a challenger and pretty much died in obscurity not too long after that. Now, look, as a black guy, I'm like, I don't know if at the time period I could have been like, well, he has politics to consider, yada, yada, yada. I don't know if I could be like, but now I can. And if I was more mature at that time, I could have also. But it underscores the innocence and the unwillingness to listen. So with baby boomers, you were either totally good or you were totally bad. And if you demonstrated anything bad, then that was problematic. If you demonstrated enough things that were good, that was wonderful. But don't demonstrate one or two things that they didn't like. This is where the millennials come in. This is where the millennials come in. Where we were so much like the baby boomers, but we were more open to hear what the system had to say and to learn not only what the system was, but how it could be utilized in ways that would be beneficial to the rest of the public. This is actually where some of the contentions within millennials come from, is many of us want to make the system work, and many of us have also given up on making the system work and have become poisoned against the idea that society can work. That's where the conflict comes in from, or comes into our generation. Baby boomers, from the start, wanting to overturn much of what the previous generation, one or two, had done, found themselves raising a new generation that was inquisitive about the world around them to a greater extent than anything the baby boomers themselves, some, you know, you do have your outliers, the baby boomers themselves had ever been. Not only was this new generation inquisitive, but they wanted to know a lot about why things were the way they were. And this bothered the baby boomers because they didn't have the answers, many of them. And nor did they want to face the reality that the reason the world was the way the world was, in many instances, was because the baby boomers had voted in politicians who created the world they were living in. Now, this seems a little unfair, and I understand that. I absolutely understand it. But you got to realize something. The baby boomers were the product of a traumatized generation. The generation that had fought in World War II was very traumatized. And when they came home and created babies, that trauma was not left on the battlefield. It was carried into their homes. And so a lot of baby boomers were repressed in some form or fashion or way. When they then went to raise their children, that repression showed up as an inability to nurture correctly, or at least that's how I view it. It also showed up in It also showed up in unconscious abusive tendencies. Whether that abuse was physical, whether it was mental, whether it was emotional, whether it was spiritual. That generation, not knowing how to cope and deal with the newer generation, tried to contort that generation into boxes which they felt they were better equipped to deal with. And as you could probably imagine, it didn't go very well. This, I believe, to this day, I believe, this is why grunge music took off, one. It's also why New Jack Swing music took off the way that it took off. And why some of the music styles that were more DJ-oriented, party-oriented, but more kind of psychedelic took off. Because the depression of the generation of the millennials, and particularly of Generation X, which is often left out of these conversations, but Generation X was really palpable and was, it existed on a very high level in high capacity throughout their social contacts. Depression also reigned. Anxiety also reigned. There were problems that were not being addressed, and the music was a way to communicate those problems. A desire to escape those problems rose in the form of the psychedelic and the techno music. It was all a means of trying to escape from the way that the baby boomer generation was trying to shape Generation X and the millennials into boxes which they could handle. When that didn't work, when they couldn't force Generation X and millennials into those boxes, particularly millennials, what began to happen? Medication, dosing of the generation to try to get them to be in a form, in a way that was more manageable. I mean, literally, parents would say that. I just need them to be more manageable. Now, look, Am I saying that some people didn't need the medication? No, I'm not. Some of the kids definitely need the medication. But I am saying that it got overprescribed. A lot of parents, overstressed by life, by work, by politics, particularly their inability to pick good politicians who are going to aid in solving problems that were afflicting them, they used dosing, they used television, they used sweet things with a lot of sugar and artificial sweeteners in them. They used all of that stuff to numb their child to reality and to make them docile to the extent that they could. Am I saying this was all conscious? No. What I am saying, though, is that it was widespread and that it became a cultural problem from that cross-generational position. Baby boomer generation didn't want to accept the responsibility. I was going to say didn't want to grow up, but I think that's harsh. They didn't want to accept the responsibility of taking care of the development of their own children. How do I know? Look at the politics that they voted for. Look at the politics that they espoused. Look at the politics that they followed, even in the 80s and the 90s. Everything was about cutting off funding for things that would help their children become successful just like they were successful. In short, the baby boomer generation was obsessed with controlling the competitive potential of coming generations. They literally sabotaged the society to break down once when they either left the scene completely or started to leave in mass numbers, aka die. Now you may, again, you may say, "Oof, that is a hell of a charge. That's a hell of a charge." I mean, they've obviously done some good things, and every generation does good, every generation does bad, absolutely. But that's a hell of a charge. How can you make that charge? I can make that charge by looking at the broader patterns of what this generation did. It doesn't mean that I don't love them. It doesn't mean that I don't like them. But their legacy is their legacy. And even now, when the hour is late and we are trying, my generation, Generation X, and the newest generation, we're trying to fix the mistakes that they made, they refuse to cooperate in a meaningful way to make sure that the mistakes they made can be reconciled. Which brings me back to OK Boomer. One of the videos that I recently seen when I typed in, you know, OK Boomer video, was this older man, probably a conservative, telling this young person that they don't get the world, that they'll never get the world, that they'll have to grow up and see that the world works in a certain way and that X, Y, and Z is just going to always be true, and they needed to shut up, sit down, and live with it. And the young person, who was opposite screen of the guy talking, held up a sign that said, "Okay, Boomer," and just kept pointing to it. The amount of frustration that millennials and Generation E have comes to baby boomers has yet to ever be measured. And I suspect it hasn't been measured because, frankly, if it was measured and it was given a measuring point 0 to 100, I think even millennials would be surprised at how high frustration was at their elders. I think even millennials would be shocked because we all don't get together and like bash older people or bash the baby boomers. We got other things to talk about. And when we do bring up baby boomers or, you know, some older person, we typically do it to talk about something that needs to get done that wasn't done with that generation, or we are citing the person because their work is important to the work that we're doing, to the activism we are doing, engaging in and the like. For me, this generation has very limited prospects for the future. My generation has very limited prospects for the future, unless we change things drastically. Therefore, okay, boomer, is not simply a model of frustration. It's deeper than that. It's dismissing the negative derision that the baby boomers project at Generation X, millennials, and Generation E all the time. They tell us we can't do nothing all the time. Now, I know there's some people who fall outside of that, but most baby boomers just constantly tell not only their children, but their grandbabies, you can't fix the world because they're pessimistic. For me, okay, boomer, is a rejection of the unwillingness to listen to the elders. But they're not stuck on stupid. They want to listen to the elders. They just don't want to hear the negativity, particularly the shutting down of ideas because the baby boomers can't see how those ideas are possible in the world as they're constructed. Okay, boomer is a key in a lock that says we are tapping into your mission, and we are going to take upon our backs your mission along with our own, and we are going to complete both. You can tell us that we can't do it all you want, but we are pushing ahead with or without you. Okay, boomer also is a statement of check for the boomer. It is asking you to look at what you're saying and how useful it is. Now, there's some time when, yes, hard truths are going to have to be taken in and going to have to be searched through. Yes. But a hard truth is very different than a boomer rejection. And everybody who heard me say that knows what I'm talking about. When a boomer rejects an idea that you have or rejects the possibility that you're going to be able to do something that you want to be able to do, they are brutal. And they're not only brutal, but they are dismissive to the point of trying to annihilate the hope that you hold internally that what you can get, what you can do is possible, that you can actually get it done, which is what I meant to say there. Okay, boomer is an attempt to push that back and to deflect it. Finally, Okay Boomer is a statement of pride. When, and some boomers listening may have experienced this, when you are talking to a millennial, when you are talking to a Generation E, and you are giving them some advice, and they do not say, okay, boomer, that is an acknowledgement of you speaking to them on their level with the respect that they show you. And you are willing to give them criticisms that are constructive rather than destructive. That's what okay boomer means, at least to me. Maybe I'll have some more in the future about what that actually means. We are now in the time period when this cross-generational thing is going to have to be stitched back together. Baby boomers have no legitimacy anymore when it comes to the millennials, Generation X, Generation E. I'm hesitant to speak for X. But I will include them here nonetheless. I think towards the end of Generation X, you know, those people who are 20, 30 in the early 2000s into the late 2000s, I think they started seeing the baby boomers as lacking in legitimacy. And because of that, you know, we invite them to join our ranks. At the end of the day, though, again, this cross-generation thing has to be stitched together. It's not about shaming the baby boomers. It's not about getting rid of the baby boomers. It's not about depleting their potential when it comes to their ability to help us build the better world. The idea behind OK Boomer is to really get them to notice the problems in their thinking and in their actions so that they can teach us what we need to know to make this world better. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. Check me out at radio, the number 4, ALL.net. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.net. You can hit me up on WordPress, on Spotify, on Amazon Music, on just about everywhere. You can also find me on Facebook. For a time, I'm going to be on X, even though I may be moving that to another platform, so don't be surprised by that. I really enjoy it every single time I put one of these out here and see that y'all are listening and that you are thinking. So whatever your comment is, please don't hesitate to give me a shout via email, maybe even drop by Class War Battlefield Podcast on Facebook and drop me a line. If you like the work that I'm doing, please drop some change in the digital hat. $2, $5, $10, $20, $30, $50, whatever you can do to help will help me. CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, that is at both Cash App and PayPal. CWB Podcast, PayPal, and Cash App. I am, really, really quickly, big up to Dr. Obi Tshaka, big up to Professional Left Podcast, the best podcast you are not listening to. Please rectify that immediately. Big up to all of my progressive media spots. If you want a complete list of the progressive media ecosystem that I often tap into, you can go to wordpress.com/ClassWarBattlefieldPodcast. And it'll be right there at the top. Just click into any episode and you'll see it right there on the little bar. So, again, I'm your brother, Brian Miradiso Gaia. And I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Until the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.